Just graduated from Luther Northwestern Seminaries in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I've been assigned to the Southeastern Minnesota District of the American Lutheran Church, so I'm waiting for a call. I've been up here for 2 weeks now, and will be here for another week with my husband, Morris Wee, and our 8-week-old son, Kai. My presentation today and my husband's tomorrow fall under the more general category of the Bible as literature. And so you can keep that in mind today during the session. Why don't we join together in a word of prayer? Gracious God, we thank you for this morning, for blue sky, and for the hot and yellow sun that is ascending over Buckskin. Bless those out hiking today. Guard their step and bring them back safely to us. We thank you also for the opportunity to study your word, to wrestle with it, and with the Spirit's guidance to find insight into its truth, for your word is truth. May it be a lamp to our feet and a light to our path. Amen. I'd like to begin by starting with a topic that might seem strange to you to discuss in a Bible study. I'd like to begin by talking about fairy tales. And I'd like you to think in your minds about fairy tales that you've grown up with. Think of Cinderella, for instance, or Sleeping Beauty, or Snow White. Any one of those three would work just fine. These are well-known stories in our culture. Practically everyone knows them. They're in our bones, sort of. I can't remember how I learned them or when I learned them, but I know them all now. The fairy tales that I've mentioned to you, the titles, are all different stories, obviously. They have different titles, their characters have different names, they present different settings, different situations, but they have some things in common. And it's the things that they have in common that I'd like to focus on for a few minutes. First of all, how do they all begin? Once upon a time. Every fairy tale starts once upon a time. That's your clue, in a way, that this is going to be a fairy tale. And then there's the common situation of a prince and a princess being separated from one another. There's something keeping them apart. Sometimes it's a spell. In Rose Red and Rose White, for instance, the prince has been turned into a frog. And so that spell needs to be broken before the lovely young princess and the lovely young prince can get together. In Cinderella, there's a class that separates them. The prince is of the upper class, the ruler of the land. Cinderella is a scullery maid sleeping in the fireplace. So class keeps them apart. Or think of Sleeping Beauty or Snow White. There's illness and evil that separates the prince and the princess. In almost every fairy tale, you'll find this situation, prince and princess separated from one another. Then in every fairy tale, there's an evil figure. You hiss and boo at that evil figure, but there's a wicked stepmother often. Or there's, in Cinderella, for instance, there are the wicked old mean stepsisters. And then another thing that's in common in these fairy tales is that this evil figure is, in the end, always overcome. The wicked stepmother is banished from the land. The wicked stepsisters get their comeuppance when Cinderella is the one who gets the prince. The evil figure is overcome always at the end of a fairy tale. And then, at the end of a fairy tale, the man and the woman are always joined in a happy union. And the fairy tale, how does a fairy tale always end? And they lived happily ever after. Every fairy tale ends that way. These things that are the fixed patterns of fairy tales are conventions. And you see that word up here on the board, conventions of biblical love stories. We'll get to that in a minute, but what I want to talk briefly about again are the conventions of fairy tales. Those are the fixed patterns, the fixed motifs that we expect to find present in a fairy tale. I named 7. There might be more. They're set characters, set situations, and a set outcome. And we rely on those things to be present in a fairy tale. We always expect them to be in a fairy tale. If we hear the words once upon a time, we can settle back. We know there will be certain kinds of characters, certain situations, and we're assured that the outcome will be, and they lived happily ever after. So thinking about that prompts a question for me. Why do we like fairy tales? Why aren't we just bored to death by them? Since we know what the characters are going to be, what the situations are going to be, and what the outcome will be. What's the intrigue for us in fairy tales? Why do we like them? Why do we tell them? I think there are many reasons that we are fascinated by them. Psychologists, sociologists, literary critics present a variety of reasons. But one that I would like to explore today, the fascination for us in the fairy tales that I would like to work with today is this. We wonder time and again, how is the writer of this new story going to use the patterns that we expect? How is the writer going to manipulate them, change them, embellish them? How is the writer going to present them in a new way? And our intrigue, our fascination of fairy tales, I think, lies in part in how the writer is going to use the conventions. Will it take three different episodes for the evil figure to be overcome, or will the evil figure become overcome in one situation? Those are the kinds of intrigues that I think fairy tales hold for us. The use of convention is manipulated, changed, embellished by the writer. And that's part of the intrigue for us in fairy tales. We're fascinated by the detail and how the writer is going to use or change those. The writer of the fairy tale uses these conventions to do several things. And I'd like to look at just three. First of all, the writer uses these conventions to tell us about the character. For example, it's expected in a fairy tale that the princess will be kind and gentle and loving and meek and mild. That's an expectation of a fairy tale. But what if Cinderella, for instance, once talked back to her stepsisters? That would be a breaking of the fairy tale convention, and it would tell us something about the character Cinderella. Our expectations would be broken, and we'd think, aha, here's a different kind of heroine in this fairy tale. And we'd start paying closer attention to her because the convention had been broken. We'd be awakened, and we'd start paying attention to her. So the author can use the conventions to tell us about characters just by changing a quick little detail, like having Cinderella talk back to her stepsisters instead of being long-suffering and patient and mild. The author can also use conventions to delay the resolution of a fairy tale. For instance, our expectations in the story of Cinderella are that when the prince arrives at the door with the slipper to try it on the women living in that house, our expectations are that Cinderella will be home and the story is soon coming to its conclusion, right? But what if Cinderella happened to have been sent out by her mean old ugly stepsisters to go to the store to buy some cosmetics or something like that, and Cinderella weren't home when the prince came to try the slipper on the women of that household? Then we'd think, aha, the writer of this fairy tale is going to have to figure out another way to get Cinderella and the prince together, and the story would go on for a little bit longer. So the author can use conventions to delay the resolution of a story. The author can also use conventions to shock us, to challenge our sense of order. And this is, I think, the most powerful way that conventions are used in storytelling. For example, when the prince comes to the house of Cinderella and the shoe is tried on, first the oldest stepsister, then the next oldest stepsister, and then Cinderella, we expect that the shoe will fit Cinderella. That's what the conventions have pointed us to. Cinderella is the heroine of that fairy tale. But what if the shoe fit one of the older stepsisters? Wouldn't we be shocked by that? Wouldn't that upset our sense of order? Wouldn't that upset the way we expected that fairy tale to come out? We'd be jolted, shocked by that. And so the author can use conventions to challenge our sense of order, to upset us. Because of these conventions and the way they work in us, they get in our blood and our bones, and they're part of how we live. Because of these conventions, we expect certain endings to fairy tales. And when those expectations are met, when the fairy tale ends the way we expect it to, we call that a comic tale. The man and the woman are married at the end. It's joyful and they live happily ever after. When the fairy tale doesn't end the way conventions make us expect it to end, that's called a tragic or ironic tale. We're upset by the ending of that. The conventions are broken. Order is upset, and there's no resolution. As, for instance, if the shoe fit one of the older sisters, or if the prince in the story of Snow White, on his way to rescue Snow White, if he were killed on the way to rescue her. We're shocked by that. That's a tragic or an ironic tale. And I think this is a digression for a moment, but one of the things that's happening today in much of literature, drama, film, in the arts, is that writers and artists are telling ironic or tragic tales. We've been raised with our conventions to expect certain endings, and writers today are jolting us with unexpected endings. Think, for instance, did any of you see the movie Chinatown that came out many years ago, or the movie that's more recent, Shoot the Moon? They both have similar situations, and I think I'll describe Chinatown for you. It's a story of San Francisco, and it starred Faye Dunaway and Jack Nicholson. And Faye Dunaway is of course a beautiful woman, a young woman, and it's essentially a story of their love story. But in the midst of the love story, Jack Nicholson gets mixed up with the mafioso of Chinatown. And there's a lot of drama. He and Faye Dunaway are separated by several instances, and you get this feeling of impending doom. But it's a love story, and the conventions of a love story shape the audience to expect a happy outcome. They will ride away into the sunset and live happily ever after. And at the end of the film, there is in fact a scene like that. They're driving down a street in Chinatown, mobs around the car, and they're in a convertible, so you can see the two of them sitting there. And our expectations for this love story are that they will ride away in this convertible happily and live happily ever after. But just when you're sighing a huge sigh of relief, thinking all this crime and difficulty of the film has been overcome and they will indeed live happily ever after, just at that moment a shotgun rings out and a woman starts to scream, and Faye Dunaway at the driver's seat falls forward on the horn of the car, and you hear this screaming woman and this blare of the car horn, and the door of the car falls open and Jack Nicholson falls out slumping, red blood coming out of his body. And that the power of that film, I think, was that we were set up to expect a happily ever after, man and woman driving away in a convertible, ending. That's the convention of the fairy tale. And just before the ending, it's exploded in our faces. Order is upset. And I think the use of convention in that film and the upset, the twisting of convention, gives it profound shock to us, even though we don't consciously think of it working on our minds. That's why we like, for instance, this recent film about runners. What's the name of it? Yeah, Chariots of Fire. Because there the conventions are set up. You know, Eric, the young man from Scotland running on the heath, and the young man in Oxford meeting Mimi, the actress, and then all these runners go over to France to participate in the Olympics, and they win. They don't lose, they win. And when the man coming back who had met this woman, Mimi, that was sort of up in the air before they went to run the Olympics, when he walks off the boat, she's standing there, parasol in hand, ready to greet him. And the story ends the way we are set up to expect it. And that's part of the satisfaction of that film. Our expectations are met. But what if they had all lost? Or what if Mimi hadn't been there to meet him? You know, that's the upset. And the use of convention can be very powerful that way. What I'd like to do now is to turn to the Bible and look at the use of convention in the Bible. And I'd like to say first that I, in using, first of all, fairy tales. I'm not implying that the work, that the stories in the Bible that I'm turning to are fairy tales. I don't want to make that implication. What I started out with fairy tales, what I hope to do is to show in fairy tales how convention works. And what I'd like to do now is turn to the Bible and show how convention works there. So that's what I'd like to turn to next. And the stories of the Bible that I'd like to look at and examine the use of convention in are biblical love stories. I happen to like love stories, and I like the love stories in the Bible, so that was an easy place for me to turn to. And I'd like to look at three stories: Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Rachel, and Moses and his... Many people don't know that his wife's name was Zipporah, and so I'd like to look at their love story as a third one. There are many more in the Bible, but I'd like to focus on those three. I've written up on the board, outlined for you before we get into it, the conventions of the love story in the Bible. And I'd like to explore those now. I'll carry this mic. I've done this work ahead of time for you. If we had a couple hours, it'd be fun for us to read the stories and come up with the conventions ourselves, because they're all there. But to save time, I've outlined them for us. Every biblical love story begins with a bridegroom, a hopeful bridegroom, traveling to a foreign land. We have a man here who walked in and saw this list on the board and said, "That's just what I did. I traveled to Africa to meet my wife." So we still have love stories like this happening today. In this foreign land, he meets a young woman or young women. Depends. And if you're interested in Hebrew, the word in the Bible in the Old Testament is always the same for this young woman or young women. Na'ara. And the use of this word always in the love story makes you think, why is that one word always being used? So there's a pattern there. The third step of this biblical love story is that they always meet at a well. Fourth, someone always draws water from the well. Sometimes it's the man. Once we'll see it's the woman. But someone always draws water from the well. Fifth, the young woman or the young women rush home with the news of the stranger's arrival. Sixth, the stranger is invited to a meal. Sometimes it's a feast. Sometimes, as we'll see, it's a pretty meager repast. And then seven, the story always concludes with a betrothal between the man and the woman. These are the conventions of biblical love story. The list, a list which is much like the conventions of fairy tales that we looked at. But these are the specific conventions of the Old Testament biblical love stories. And now I'd like us to turn to Genesis 24, verse 10, and we can begin to look at the first one, Isaac and Rebekah. And while you're doing that, I'd like to introduce you to a book that has been very helpful to me in this study and in other studies of the Bible as literature. It's a book that just came out last summer. It's called The Art of Biblical Narrative, and it's by a man named Robert Alter, A-L-T-E-R. And if you're interested in looking at this book, I have it up here. You're welcome to look at it afterwards. It's kind of a scholarly book. It's one of the most important books that's come out recently about literary approaches to the Bible, which is quite a new field of biblical study. And so it's not a real accessible book, but it's a very interesting book and I think a very important book. I think 20 years from now, we're going to be looking back and talking about Alter's book as significant. So if you'd like to take a look at it, it's up here. So, Genesis 24. What I'd like to do is follow the pattern through first, find the conventions in the story, then we'll look at the significance of how the writer uses them. Let's start in verse 10. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed. The scene before this is that Abraham is concerned about his son Isaac. Isaac doesn't have a wife yet. And so the decision is made to send a servant, one of Abraham's servants, off to a foreign land from where Abraham is living to find a wife for Isaac. And that's indeed what happens. The servant goes, and that's one of the first changes of the convention that we'll have to talk about. It's not the bridegroom traveling, it's a surrogate. The family sends a servant instead of Isaac. So we'll talk about why that happens. There's a change in the convention already. And where does he go? Goes to Mesopotamia, to a city of Nahor. And then in verse 11, or in verse 15, wait a minute. Okay, in verse 11, he goes to a well. So we have these three first conventions. Someone traveling to a foreign land, and they go to a well. And then in verse 15, Rebecca comes to the well. A young woman comes to the well. Then in verse 16, the young woman fills her jar. Someone draws water from the well. In this instance, it's Rebecca who draws the water from the well. In verse 28, Rebecca runs home and tells her mother's household about the things that she's seen at the well. Convention number 5, the young woman rushes home with the news. There it is in the story. In verse 31, the servant is invited to the home of Rebecca. In verse 33, he's served a meal. And in verses 58 and following, the betrothal is concluded between Isaac and Rebecca. Rebecca is asked, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." So that's briefly an outline of the conventions of biblical love stories in this particular story. Let's go back and look at some of the details to see how the writer uses the conventions and what the writer's hoping to tell us with the use of those conventions. First of all, I noted that it's not Isaac who goes, as the convention would expect us, would set us up to expect. But who goes? It's a servant, a surrogate. And it's interesting that to me that Isaac stays at home and the servant does Isaac's work, essentially. It's interesting to know that and then to think about Isaac's personality in the Old Testament stories. I think of all the patriarchs, he's the most passive. He's the victim who's offered as a sacrifice. He's bound on the altar, hands and feet, by his father Abraham. He's the passive victim in that scene. Again, when his son Jacob is trying to get the birthright, he's tricked by him. Isaac just sits there sort of old and blind and lets Jacob run all over him. And his one big scene in the Bible is on his deathbed, where he's just about breathing his last gasp, and he says a few words before he dies. Isaac of the patriarchs is the most passive. If you compare him to Abraham, for instance, who travels thousands of miles, and Jacob, who's always conniving and tricking, and if you think of Joseph, who goes to Egypt and leads his people and works there for many, many years to have his people be safe, Isaac is just sort of a shadow in the background compared to those men. And it's interesting that in this love story, he is also passive. He's not present. The servant is the one doing his work. Isn't that an interesting use there? And it tells us something that is important about Isaac. We also learn important things about Rebecca from the use of the convention. I said that normally in the biblical love stories, it's the man who draws the water. In this story, it's Rebecca. And that gives you a clue. Here's a strong woman who's going to dominate, and she continues to dominate this scene. In just a few verses in the Hebrew, she's the subject of 11 verbs. She's like a whirlwind of activity. She runs to the well. She gets water. She runs over to the camel. She waters the camel. She runs back to the well, draws water, gives it to Isaac. She's just doing, 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 doing all the time. She dominates the scene. And it's interesting also that she's described as a virgin, very fair, and her genealogy is traced through her mother, Milcah. And also in verse 28, as we saw, her household is referred to as her mother's household. And Israel, for the whole Old Testament time, was quite patriarchal. Genealogies were traced through the fathers. You lived in your father's household, not your mother's. But here, that convention is twisted a little bit, and it tells us again Here's a woman who's a matriarch. Here's a woman who's a strong woman. And so that tells us something. And then in verse 58, it's Rebecca who is asked, will you go with this man? And she's the one who says, yes, I will go. It's not her father who says, yes, she will go, or her mother. It's Rebecca making the decision for herself. So here, there are just a few conventions that are, it might seem like minor details, but they tell us about the person Rebecca. She's the one who draws the water, not the man. Her genealogy is traced through her mother, not her father. And she's the one who makes the decision, who concludes this betrothal, not the parents, as would be expected. So that sets us up to expect Rebecca later on to be a take-charge kind of person, and in fact, she is that. She's the one who helps her son Jacob get the birthright from his twin brother Esau, isn't she? She's the one who skins the animals and puts the hair on him, and she's going to be a powerful matriarch to contend with. So the use of convention in this story, the change of minor details alerts us to what we can expect later on from these people. Let's look again then at the story of Rachel and Jacob in Genesis 29 and see how a convention is used there. We can compare this first to the story of Isaac and Rebekah. It's shorter. Theirs was 51 verses. This is only 20 verses. There's less dialogue. The dialogue that there is mainly question and answer. It's quick. Where are you? I'm here. Where are the camels out in the field? This is real short, cryptic. There's less repetition. And here we find an emotional love story. The story of Isaac and Rebecca was like the marriage of two families. A treaty was being established. A little cool. Here there's passion. Jacob works for 7 years to win the woman of his love. So those are some of the differences. Right away, let's start with verse 1 in the story. Then Jacob went on his journey. Who is the one going this time? It's Jacob, isn't it? It's not some servant or surrogate, but it's Jacob. So right away, that clues us into something about him. He's a little more active than Isaac. He's going to be in control. And where does he go? He goes to a foreign land. In verse 1 it says he goes to the land of the people of the east. He's left his homeland, traveled to a foreign land. So we're getting set up here to expect a love story. Where do they go? Where does he end up in verse 2? Goes to a well, doesn't he? Genesis 29 we're working in. And he goes to a well, which is in a field. In the other love story, the well was in the outside the city of Nahor. And that's an interesting change of detail. Jacob is much more a pastoral person, a shepherd who's out in the fields with his flocks his whole life. And just that little detail is kind of interesting, that the well is in a field as over against a city. And here there's a new detail in verse 2. There's a stone on top of the well. There was no stone in the Isaac and Rebekah story. So I'll have to take note of that. In verse 9, Rachel comes to the well. The man and the woman meet at a well. In verse 10, Jacob removes the stone over the well, and Jacob draws the water. It's not the woman this time who draws the water, but it's the man. It's Jacob. In verse 12, Rachel runs to tell her father the news. In verse 13, Jacob is invited home to Laban's household. But note, there's no meal served. What? Note that. We'll come back to that. And in verse 19, 7 years later, the betrothal is established between Jacob and Rachel, and finally a meal is mentioned. Jacob had to work 7 years to get his betrothal feast. And why don't we look at that detail first? It tells us something, I think, about Laban. We saw him in Genesis 24 in the previous story. Why don't we turn back to that, to Genesis 24, verses 29 and 30. It says, Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and Laban ran out to the man to the spring. This is when the servant is there. When he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, and when he heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, he said to the man, in verse 31, "Come in, O blessed of the Lord, why do you stand outside?" That's a devastating characterization of Laban, isn't it? That he looks first. What does he see first? The ring. Then he sees the bracelets on her hand. And then he listens to her words. And then this shrewd man sizes it all up and says, "Come on in." He's kind of set up as a greedy old man here, isn't he? And we see that again in Genesis 29 in the story of Jacob and Rachel. Laban does not serve Jacob a big meal, does he? He puts him right to work. He's going to get his 7 years out of this man. It tells you something about Laban, that meal is left out of this story. Let's go back then and look at some of the details of the convention in this story and see how they're used. We've talked already about how it's Jacob who comes, not a servant. Jacob's going to be a more active character we can expect in this story. We noted that there's a stone on top of the well, and it's a very heavy stone. It says in the text in verse 2 and 3, "The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place upon the mouth of the well." The stone is mentioned three times in one verse. And in Hebrew and in these stories, which are so cryptic and short, if a word is mentioned, if something is mentioned three times in one verse, it's a clue to pay attention to that. Stone, 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 stone. It sort of echoes through the beginning sentences of this story. And it says that the stone is so huge that it takes many shepherds to move it. And what happens in the story? Jacob alone goes up to the stone on top of the well, takes it in his broad arms, and moves it alone by himself off the well. This is a clue, I think, to the Jacob that we'll meet later on in Genesis. Jacob is the man who wrestles with God, isn't he? And wrestles all night long. He's such a strong man. And finally, the angel of Yahweh can only defeat Jacob by touching him in a sensitive part of his leg making him limp, weakening him that way. Jacob is such a strong man. Jacob is also a man who, when he was fleeing just before this, sat down in the field of Bethel, put a stone under his head, and had this dream. And the next morning, to commemorate the dream, he built a stone altar to commemorate that and named that place Bethel. Stones are throughout Jacob's life. And he's one who must wrestle and struggle. He's the one who has to work 7 years to get his bride. And then another 7 years because he got tricked and was given Leah instead of the woman for whom he was working. Nothing comes to Jacob throughout his life without struggle, without wrestling. And the stone on top of the well here, which is a different detail in the conventions of the love story, gives us a clue to that. And it also shows us what a patriarch Jacob is, that he alone can go and take this stone that it takes many shepherds to move. He alone can move that stone. And it gives us a clue to the character of Jacob that as hard as his difficulties are going to be, he's going to have to work 14 years for the woman he loves. He's going to end up wrestling with God. He's a strong man who will fight and strive and overcome. So just in that little detail of the story, we get a clue to all of Jacob, who he is. So the details are so important in this. And Rachel, what about Rachel? Compared to Rebecca, she's really passive in this story, isn't she? Rebecca was just a flurry of activity with all kinds of verbs used for her. Rachel has only a couple verbs. She runs to tell her father, and that's the convention. She's of the love story. She fits into the convention. It's her beauty that wins Jacob, not her activity or her person so much as over against Rebecca. So let's go on to look at the third love story in the Old Testament, Zipporah and Moses, which is in Exodus chapter 2. Verses 15b to verses 21. This is an interesting one because notice how short it is compared to the other love scenes. It's 6.5 verses long. That's it. Just 6.5 verses. It's very short compared to the 51 of the story of Isaac and Rebecca. But it's interesting, and it shows the power of convention, I think, because in 6.5 verses, every element of the convention of biblical love stories appears. So why don't we go through the story, and we'll find that. We'll find those. Verse 15b, we're introduced to our character, Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. In just half a verse, we have three elements of the biblical love story convention, don't we? We're introduced to our future bridegroom, Moses. He's gone to a foreign land, to Midian, up out of Egypt into Midian, and he sits down by, of course, a well. Three of those conventions are met in just a short verse. In verse 16, we're introduced to the women. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flocks. Now here, there's a change in the convention, and we'll come back to look at that. It's not one specific woman, Rebecca or Rachel, who's named by name, but it's a group of women, 7 sisters, the daughters of the priest of Midian, who come. So we'll have to come back and try to understand why there's nobody mentioned by name. Then in verse 17, Moses must drive the shepherds away so that the women can feed their flocks. The shepherds come and drive the women away, then Moses comes and drives the shepherds away so that the women can come back to the well. And in verse 17, Moses waters the flock. And quite a deal is made out of that. You'll notice in verses 17 and 19, it's mentioned 3 times in this short story that Moses is the one who waters the flocks. Verse 17b, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. In verse 19, the daughters have gone back to their father. They're retelling the story, and they say twice, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. It's emphasized in this short story that Moses 3 times watered the flocks. Why is that? We'll have to come back and explain that one. Verse 18, the women go home to the father. That convention is met. Verse 20, Moses is invited to the home. The priest says, why didn't you bring this man along? Go and get him. Come and we'll feed him bread. So in verse 20, we have the meal. It's a simple meal, but Moses is fed bread. And then in verse 21, there's a betrothal between Zipporah and Moses. The story, the love story is concluded. The man and woman are together. Now, I've mentioned a couple changes in the love story convention that we need to go back to and examine more closely. First of all, let's go to verse 16. Why is not one daughter singled out? Why does it take till the end of the story to find out that he marries Zipporah? And that's a little problematic for me. The best idea that I could come up with about it, and you can give me your ideas too later on, is that Zipporah, first of all, is not an important matriarch or woman in the Old Testament. I remember that it was just a couple of years ago that I even knew the name of Moses' wife. She's not an important figure like Rachel or Rebecca, who have many stories about them and who are mentioned again in the New Testament. Those are important matriarchs. Zipporah just sort of fades into the background. Another thing about Moses is that his life is not a domestic life, like Isaac's life is, or like Jacob's life is. Many of the stories about Isaac and Jacob that we have and that we read revolve around their homes. There are stories about relationships between them and their sons, them and their wives, them and their brothers and sisters. They're family men. Moses, however, is the leader of the people. He's a public figure. And just as we don't hear much about Zipporah after this, so even in this love story, it's just a quick little glimpse sort of into the domestic life of Moses before we go on to read in book after book after book about Moses' public career as the leader of his people. So those are some of the reasons why I've thought that Zipporah wasn't singled out. Moses is not a domestic family man. He's the savior of his people. Then why is it mentioned so many times in such a short story that Moses waters the flock? What significance do water and Moses have with one another? Think back. Moses' name means taken from the waters. He's the baby boy who's put in a basket and floated down the river. Isn't he? Water is what saves Moses' life. He's found on the shores by Pharaoh's daughter, who says, I'll raise him. We won't kill this little Hebrew boy. He'll be raised as an Egyptian prince. Moses is the one who leads his people through the Red Sea, stands and parts the waters so that they can be delivered. And toward the end of his, or further on when they're in the wilderness, Moses becomes angry at Yahweh, you remember, and strikes the rock because the people are so hungry and thirsty. And water comes from the rock, but the Lord becomes angry with Moses for becoming angry with him and not trusting. But there again, water is another symbol in Moses' life. So it's interesting that in this love story, in these short, short verses, water is mentioned many times for such a short story. And when we sit back and reflect on that, it makes sense that in Moses' life, water would be mentioned because he's a water man. What I'd like to do now, with all this stuff in our heads now, is to turn to the New Testament, to John chapter 4. And what I'd like to do is to explore in the story of Jesus and the woman at the well the significance of these conventions of biblical love scenes. There's a little bit of background in the book of John that's important for us. If we were to begin with John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and read through the book of John up to chapter 4, we would encounter two things that I think are, at least two things, but especially two things that are significant for us in this chapter. The first is in John 2, verses 1 through 11, and that's the story of the wedding at Cana, where Jesus turns the water into wine. So in John 2, we encounter a wedding, a marriage. We'd have that in our heads then, wouldn't we, when we were reading along? And in John 3, let's turn to John 3. That's even more significant. Just before we encounter the story of Jesus and the woman at the well, we find in John 3, John the Baptist speaking. He's speaking to Jews in an argument over purification. And note the metaphors that he uses to talk about himself, about the people, and about Jesus. Verses 28 and 29. John says, "You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is now full. He must increase, but I must decrease." That's sort of a thick metaphor to try to untangle. But what John the Baptist is doing is using marital language to describe this situation and these relationships. John the Baptist is the friend of the bridegroom. Christ is the bridegroom, and the people are the bride. That's the metaphor that's being worked with here, just before we hit chapter 4. And so in the reader's mind, in the hearer's mind, going through the book of John, there's the wedding at Cana, and then there's this metaphor of Jesus as the bridegroom that are in our heads just when we hit John 4, verse 1. So let's turn there. "Now when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee. He had to pass through Samaria, so he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and so Jesus, wearied as he was with his journey, sat down beside the well. It was about the sixth hour." What are we being set up here to expect? I think we're being set up to expect a love story, a biblical love story. People of Jesus' time were steeped in the Old Testament much more than we are today. They were familiar with the story of Isaac and Rebekah, of Jacob and Rachel, of Zipporah and Moses, and of many other love stories that we didn't have time to go through, but that I can mention to you. There's the story of Ruth, which is a biblical love story with these same conventions used. There's the story of Saul, that's a biblical love story. In the book of Tobit, which is an apocryphal book, where a biblical love story uses these conventions. Samson and Delilah. Those are some of the other love stories that work with these conventions that we didn't have time to look at. Steeped in those conventions, a man and a woman at a well mean what? A love story, betrothal scene. I think we're being set up here to expect that. Jesus is the bridegroom. John the Baptist has just referred six verses before to Jesus as the bridegroom. Now here we find Jesus traveling from Judea to a foreign land, goes to Samaria on his way to Galilee, just with the biblical conventions. Where does he come to? He comes to Jacob's well, sits down at a well. And what does he find there? In verse 7, he finds a woman at the well. A woman of Samaria comes to what? Draw water. Another biblical convention. And what happens in verse 7? Jesus asks her to draw him a drink. And that was using many of the same words that the servant said to Rebekah, "Please, draw me a drink." The servant said that to Rebekah in Genesis 24. Here Jesus says that to the woman. "Draw me a drink," he says. Then we're going to skip much of this in-between material. We'll come back to it in verse 28. The woman goes back to her people. After this encounter with Jesus, she goes back to her people, a convention of the love story. And in verses 31 to 38, the disciples and Jesus talk about food. They don't eat a banquet. We'll have to look at why not. But they talk about food. And so in this story of Jesus and the woman at the well, every single convention of the biblical love story except the last, the betrothal, every single one of those conventions is here. And As an audience, then, I think we're being set up to expect a betrothal scene between Jesus and this woman at the well. We're being set up by the conventions to expect a marriage between Jesus and this woman to take place. There are a couple other clues that I skipped over. One is the mention of Jacob. It says Jacob's well, and it's interesting that that's in there, that the word Jacob is there. Jacob is the last common ancestor that Jesus and this Samaritan woman have. Jesus as a Jew is descended from Jacob's son Ephraim, and the Samaritans trace their descendants from Jacob's son Manasseh. And so if you go back tracing the genealogy, Jacob is the last common ancestor they had. After Jacob, they parted ways. And in the love stories that we've looked at, Isaac goes to his father's homeland to find a wife. And Jacob goes to his mother's homeland to find a wife. The wives that they find are common ancestors. And here, it's the same situation. Jesus and this woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, although they seem foreign, have this common ancestor. And it also reminds us, makes us think about those biblical love stories, just the mention of Jacob. But then, let's go to the verse where Jesus asks her to draw him a drink. In verse 7, Jesus says to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away to the city to buy food. What happens? Does anyone draw water? They don't. We go on and on and on in this story, and not one of them draws water, neither Jesus nor the woman. What do? Instead of drawing water, they have a theological discussion, Jesus and this woman, and they talk about the difference between earthly water and spiritual water. Water's there and it's discussed, but it's in a theological debate that water comes into this story. And the debate is about living water, the earthly water, the water of the earth that we drink, versus spiritual water, the water of the Spirit that Jesus can give. And that episode concludes with verse 15, where the woman says, "Sir, give me this water, that I may not thirst, nor come here ever again to draw." Then in verse 16, the subject switches to marriage. And I think, again, this theological discussion has sort of been a little digression, we would think. And now, hearing this story, knowing the conventions of the biblical love story, we'd think, aha, finally they're getting around to the betrothal scene. Jesus is going to propose to this woman. What does he do? He says, "Go, call your husband and come here." And so our minds are thinking fast, and the woman answers him, "I have no husband." And hearing that, we as readers or hearers can sit back and breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, great. This can be a love story then. She has no husband. Jesus is bringing up the subject of marriage. A proposal can take place here now. But what happens? The woman, it turns out, has had 5 husbands. And she's living with a man who is now, who isn't her husband. So this upsets our sense of order, doesn't it? The convention isn't being followed again. And instead of a proposal, what do we get? We get another theological discussion. They talk about worship, the difference between worshiping on the mountain and worshiping in Jerusalem, and the true worship that Jesus says he'll bring, worship in spirit and truth. And this leads up to verse 26, where we find the first climax of the story, where Jesus says to the woman, "I am the Messiah. The Messiah is he who is speaking to you." And so to this Samaritan woman, Jesus reveals his Messiahship. But that is an unexpected turn of events in this biblical love story, isn't it? The conventions aren't being followed here. Then come in the disciples. And here's another shift. The disciples provide, I think, some comic relief. They really bumble around here. They're shocked to see that Jesus is speaking to a woman. That's appalling to them. And then they go on to have this discussion about Jesus with the harvest. And they stand in contrast to the Samaritan woman. Jesus talked with her about living spiritual water, And her response finally was, "Jesus, give me this water that I might never have to draw again." Jesus tries to have a similar kind of discussion with his disciples who have lived and traveled with him for many, many days by now, talking about the difference between living earthly food and spiritual food. And the disciples don't get the point at all. They don't understand. They don't ask, "Lord, give me of that, of your food, that I might live forever." They stand in stark contrast to the woman who understood and believed. And then in verses 39 to 42, we have the second climax, where the betrothal scene is upset again. There's not one earthly marriage which we're set up by these conventions to expect. But if you'll allow me to talk about it this way, there are many spiritual marriages that take place between Jesus the bridegroom, the woman of Samaria, and all the people, and the people of her town, Sychar, who come to Jesus. They are the brides who come to this bridegroom. And instead of one betrothal scene ending in an earthly marriage where they live happily ever after, we have instead another upset of the biblical love scene convention, where the man, the bridegroom, marries in a spiritual way many people. There are many people who enter that day into an intimate, marital kind of relationship with Christ. It says in verse 39, "Many Samaritans from that city believed in him because of the woman's testimony." Now I'd briefly like to talk about the significance of all this. What time is it anyway? It's just about 10, isn't it? Okay, I'll run through this. I've long been intrigued by and puzzled by the story of Jesus and the woman at the well. I've worked with it many years, and I never could seem to get through to it. It's a rich story, and it's a hard story to figure out. There's a lot going on there. I don't mean to argue that this biblical love story convention working in it solves all the problems. It's still a rich and mysterious story to me. But this approach to it has helped me, because I think behind the story of Jesus and the woman at the well lies a story convention that helps to explain much of the mystery of this story to me. I think that it was a familiar story to the writer of John and to the readers and hearers of John. Hearing its opening sentences, a man and a woman at a well, a journey by a man into a foreign land, request by a man for drink, talk of marriage, talk of food, the audience would expect a betrothal scene between this man and woman meeting at the well. The conventions point to it. But what happens? Time and again, these conventions are upset. No one draws water. They talk instead of spiritual water. The woman has already been married 5 times, and she's living now with a 6th man who's not her husband. They talk of food, but they talk of spiritual food. They don't eat food like in the biblical love stories. The betrothal is not an earthly one, but a spiritual one. And what we find is not a patriarch like Isaac and Jacob, nor a prophet like Moses, but we find the Messiah, the Jesus, talking to this woman. I think that people hearing this story were as upset by the topsy-turvy use of convention in this story as we are by the story of Chinatown or by the film Shoot the Moon, if you've seen either one of those films. Absolutely shocked, because their sense of order was upset totally. And I think that the writer of this material is using, manipulating, changing, embellishing the convention of the biblical love story to tell us significant things about Jesus and our relationship with him. First of all, Jesus is no ordinary bridegroom. He doesn't come to enter into a singular marital relationship, a man with a woman. He comes as a bridegroom to each of us, to all of us. The story seems to tell us especially that he comes to the outcast. He comes to a woman and to the Samaritans, who were looked on by the Jews as scum of the earth. And he comes to those we least expect. He comes to this woman who's had 5 husbands and is now living with a man who's not her husband. Jesus upsets those things that our culture, the convention of our culture, makes us expect. He breaks sex roles. He talks to women. He breaks moral codes. He talks, in a way, the story sets us up to expect him to propose to an adulterous woman who's had 5 husbands. And he breaks social codes. The story sets us up to expect a proposal to a Samaritan woman. And those elements of the story would have been shocking, I think, to people hearing the story in Jesus' time. The women of the Old Testament stories were virgins. That was stressed in the stories of Rebekah and Rachel and Zipporah. and they were kinspeople, not outcasts like the Samaritans. But I think that this story, the upsets of the convention that occur in it, show us that it's not the expected earthly marriage that Jesus brings us, but a marriage of the Spirit. And that our response to this can be like the Samaritan woman, to go to bring others to this bridegroom, this Messiah, who offers us living water, who offers us living food. And with that, we, like the woman, did you notice that she, when she ran back to her town, she left her water jar at the well. She didn't need earthly water anymore. She had the water of the Spirit. So she leaves her water jar at the well, runs into town to get the other people, to bring them to this bridegroom who offered to her and to each, and who offers to each of us spiritual marriage, no matter what our race, our class, or our sex. We've lost these senses of biblical convention. It's like someone 5,000 years from now recovering our fairy tales and not really understanding them so well because they don't know the conventions behind them that we all accept and take for granted. We're raised with those conventions. It's the same when we look back on the biblical material. But I think we can recover some of those, and knowing them, this material can become alive and fresh to us as it was to them, and the shock of the story of Jesus and the woman at the well can be as powerful for us as it was for the people then. The shock that Jesus is our bridegroom, yes, but not in the way we'd expect. He's our Messiah, and that he offers to each of us an intimate relationship like a marriage in the Spirit.